Chapter 55. As time passed, and I painfully clothed the bare bones of my theoretical knowledge with practical experience, I began to realize there was another side to veterinary practice they didn't mention in the books. It had to do with money. Money has always formed a barrier between the farmer and the vet. I think this is because there is a deeply embedded, maybe subconscious conviction in many farmers' minds that they know more about their stocks than any outsider, and it is an admission of defeat to pay somebody else to doctor them. The wall was bad enough in those early days when they had to pay the medical practitioners for treating their own ailments, and when there was no free agricultural advisory service. But it is worse now, when there is the health service and NAAS, and the veterinary surgeon stands pitilessly exposed as the only man who has to be paid. Most farmers, of course, swallow the pill and get out their checkbooks. But there is a proportion, maybe about 10%, who do their best to opt out of the whole business. We had our own 10% in Darabi, and it was a small but constant irritation. As an assistant, I was not financially involved, and it didn't seem to bother Siegfried unduly except when the quarterly bills were sent out. Then it really got through to him. Miss Harbottle used to type out the accounts and present them to him in a neat pile, and that was when it started. He would go through them one by one, and it was a harrowing experience to watch his blood pressure gradually rise. I found him crouched over his desk one night. It was about 11 o'clock, and he had had a hard day. His resistance was right down. He was scrutinizing each bill before placing it face down on a pile on his left. On his right, there was a smaller pile, and whenever he placed one there, it was to the accompaniment of a peevish muttering, or occasionally a violent outburst. "Would you believe it?" he grunted as I came in. "Henry Bransom. More than 2 years since we saw a penny of his money, yet he lives like a sultan. Never misses a market for miles around, gets as tight as an owl several nights a week, and I saw him putting £10 on a horse at the races last month." He banged the piece of paper down and went on with his job, breathing deeply. Then he froze over another account. "And look at this one. Old Summers of Lowness. I bet he's got thousands of pounds hidden under his bed, but by God, he won't part with any of it to me." He was silent for a few moments as he transferred several sheets to the main pile. Then he swung round on me with a loud cry, waving a paper in my face. "Oh, no! Oh, Christ, James, this is too much. Bert Mason here owes me 27 and sixpence. I must have spent more than that sending him bills year in, year out, and do you know, I saw him driving past the surgery yesterday in a brand new car. The bloody scoundrel." He hurled the bill down and started his scrutiny again. I noticed he was only using one hand while the other churned among his hair. I hoped fervently that he might hit upon a seam of good payers, because I didn't think his nervous system could take much more. And it seems that my hopes were answered, because several minutes went by with only the quiet lifting and laying of the paper sheets. Then Siegfried stiffened suddenly in his chair, and sat quite motionless as he stared down at his desk. He lifted an account, and held it for several seconds at eye level. I steeled myself. This must be a beauty. But to my surprise, Siegfried began to giggle softly. Then he threw back his head and gave a great bellow of laughter. He laughed until he seemed to have no strength to laugh any more. Then he turned to me. "It's the Major, James," he said weakly. "The dear old gallant Major. You know, you can't help admiring the man. He owed my predecessor a fair bit when I bought the practice, and he still owes it. And I've never had a sou for all the work I've done for him. The thing is, he's the same with everybody, and yet he gets away with it. He's a genuine artist. These other fellows are just fumbling amateurs by comparison." He got up, reached up into the glass-fronted cupboard above the mantelpiece, and pulled out the whiskey bottle and two glasses. He carelessly tipped a prodigal measure into each glass and handed one to me. Then he sank back into his chair, still grinning. The Major had magically restored his good humour. Sipping my drink, I reflected that there was no doubt Major Bullivant's character had a rich, compelling quality. He presented an elegant patrician front to the world. Beautiful Shakespearean actor voice, impeccable manners, and an abundance of sheer presence. Whenever he unbent sufficiently to throw me a friendly word, I felt honored, even though I knew I was doing his work for nothing. He had a small, cosy farm, a tweed-clad wife, and several daughters who had ponies and were active helpers for the local hunt. Everything in his entire menage was right and fitting, but he never paid anybody. He had been in the district about 3 years, and on his arrival, the local tradesmen, dazzled by his facade, had fallen over each other to win his custom. After all, he appeared to be just their type, because they preferred inherited wealth in Darrowby.